corner has had so much energy all weekend.
Hi, I'm Gemma, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm really excited to be here, and I'm starting a timer that I will forget about. First of all, I just want to say thank you to the committee, and let's just take a moment to say thank you for this incredible weekend. It is clear how much love and time and energy you've put into this weekend, and Kathy invited me to be here in 2018, so it has taken a while, so I'm glad that I'm finally here. I'm just going to start with my story. My topic is how it works, I'm told, but I'll just start with how it didn't work. I am from New York City originally. I am an only child. My father was a therapist and my mother was a priest. And my father was in AA and my mother was in Al-Anon. And here I am. If they could have loved this disease out of me, they would have. If they could have educated this disease out of me, they would have. The only thing that all of that knowledge and recovery did was help me get here a lot sooner than I had planned. For me, I was plagued from a very young age with scary stories and big feelings. And I don't know which came first. If the scary stories caused the big feelings, or if the big feelings made the scary stories scarier. But all I know is that one fed off the other, and that my feelings felt fatal. And that there was nothing really going on in my particular house that warranted me feeling the way I felt. I had a happy home, but I was terrified of running out of anything, of love, of acceptance, of sugar. And sugar actually was my first drug of choice. I was allergic to it, so I wasn't allowed to have it, and I would sneak it, hide it, steal it, you know, and then I would get these hangovers, and then I'd lie about it. So it was a good practice ground for what was to come. And I'll tell this story of about, I don't know, 6 years ago, I was in the car with my son, and he was asking me, he was sitting in the back seat, and he said, "Mom, can you name two animals that are the same but different?" And I thought, this is a weird game, so I just said, squirrels and ferrets. And he said, "Okay." And now I was thinking about the next one. I'm like, okay, then I'll go to horse and zebra, and then I can wait. But what he said was, "Have you ever felt like everyone else is a squirrel, but you're a ferret?" And I don't know exactly what that question meant to him, but I do know that it took my six-year-old son to explain to me exactly how I felt when I was 6 years old, which is that I look very similar to everyone else, but you all have a different rule book. You're doing something different. I felt so different and so on the outside of every group I've ever been in or wanted to be part of. And then I had my first drink when I was 5 years old, and I was in communion, and I was having a particularly bad five-year-old day, and I remember going up frustrated, angry, resentful, and I had a sip of wine, and I got tremendous relief at five. And I was like, this is it. We have to come to church all the time. I didn't get that there was alcohol available other places, and to me at five there wasn't. And my dad was a newcomer, and he was taking me up to communion, and I was holding the wine in my cheeks till we got back to the seat, because it was like my one drink of the week, and I had to like let it ride. And I started going to meetings when I was five. And I remember there was a saying there in New York that I used to love to say around the house, which is, if your ass falls off, you pick it up, you put it in a paper bag, and you take it to a meeting. I just think I liked saying a bad word. But I remember the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous in my family. Alcoholics Anonymous took my father, who was a pretty angry guy, and it magically transformed him into a moderately angry guy. Like, but I could tell if he hadn't been to a meeting, and I could tell what happened here. I have never doubted the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I did know that you guys didn't drink and that I didn't want to end up here until I had to. And I remember also my son at 5, we went to communion, and I don't know, we normally wouldn't do this, but like somehow he got in a different line and he ended up having his first sip of wine at church. And on the way back to our seats, I didn't do this, but I was tempted to be like, hey, buddy, have you always felt like the world was a round hole, but you were a square peg, but right now you feel like you could fit in? Like everything feels like it's gonna be okay, like it's a warm hug. Like I didn't ask. I went outside and called my sponsor and he seemed to handle it just fine. But it is that thing as a parent, as an alcoholic parent, where you see where your kid could go and it's like, ah! But knowing that he has his own higher power. Anyway, what happened for me is that alcohol became my answer. It became my solution. It became my escape. It became my way to talk to people. It became the thing that made it possible to, I thought, be myself. I thought that who you saw when I was sober was someone else. And really, my true self is when I was drinking, because then I could say what I wanted to say. And the funny thing about it is, when I drank, I thought I was getting thinner and funnier and more together and more interesting. And I was gaining weight, and I was getting sloppy, and I was getting messier and messier. So it's like I was on the way down feeling like I was on the way up, you know? And for me, there's that distance when I drink of who I think I am and who I am, you know, who I actually am, who I'm being. And, you know, I made alcoholic decisions when I wasn't drinking. So it came time to apply to college, and there was a school I really wanted to go to, which was Northwestern. And I went to my room to apply to Northwestern, and I sat down at my desk, and I looked at the pictures, and it all looked so good, and I started to think about how, like, if I want this, it's not going to happen. And if I apply, then I'm going to have to wait. My parents are going to spend money on this application, and then I'm going to have to wait, and then I'm going to get rejected, but everyone's going to know that I applied. They're going to ask me, did you get in? And I'm going to have to say no, and we have to keep reliving that I didn't get in at the school I want to get. And so I came up with a solution to the problem that hadn't happened, which is, I'm not gonna apply. Why go through that? Why put myself through that terrible thing I just came up with? You know, I've heard here, the worst thing I ever went through never even happened, you know? And I know that people go through tremendous things in recovery, but I think that there is a lot of truth to that, is that I can go through something in my mind and then come up with a solution and then implement that solution. So then there was another school that I'd never heard of, and it just said, it was the University of Puget Sound, and it said, how does Puget Sound? And I was like, eh, they're funny, I'll go there. And I did, and it was lovely, but it's not the way to make a major life decision. And I ended up in New York when I was 19, and I had moved to San Francisco and then Tacoma, and then I ended up back in New York. And the thing about the way I drank is that my body couldn't handle the way I needed to drink. I was too small to drink the way I needed to drink. I needed to drink to fix something. Like, there was, like, major... work being done, and my body couldn't handle it. So I was a big puker, and I blacked out and I passed out, and I put myself in very dangerous predicaments. And when I went to a small school, that was okay because people knew who I was, and I was constantly being carried home, and there was, I think Rush was done like dry, and then after, so they had accepted me into a sorority and never seen me drink, and then they saw me drink once I was already in the group, and they were like, we should revisit how we do Rush. I think I made a difference. I think they let them drink now, just like, let's test this out, because I was different. I was a different version of myself when I was drunk. So my last night out, I went out for one drink, and the minute I had that drink, I said to my friend, why don't we have one drink in every bar on St. Mark's Place? Like, that was the new plan. I ended up blacking out, I ended up passing out, I ended up passing out on 9th Avenue, and I had all of my money on me. I was not dressed in a way, I mean, I don't know what the correct outfit for a 19-year-old to be sleeping on the sidewalk at 4 o'clock in the morning is, but I wasn't wearing it. And a guy just walked by, and he didn't help, he didn't stop, but he just said, that's not a good idea. And I could hear that, you know, and because I was passed out alone on the street. My dad came over the next day and was just like, I told him everything. Like, I had that kind of willingness that you get from alcohol poisoning that would have gone away. Like, it would have passed, but I had this tiny window of willingness where I didn't want to do this anymore. And I told my sober dad, who at this point had 15 years, exactly what I was doing and with whom and for what and all of it, you know, which was probably a lot for him to hear about his little girl, but he did not freak out. In fact, he said, what's the next thing you need to do? And I had to get to work, and I couldn't stop throwing up, and he offered to buy me more alcohol. And that was part of the problem, is I was 19, you know? It was like, the idea of getting sober was like, it wasn't legal for me to drink, so I really felt it should be illegal for me to get sober. Like, and, but it wasn't. My mother, shortly thereafter, a couple days later, said, you know, she was in Al-Anon, and she's like, here's the deal. We're spending a lot of money to send you to college, and we think you're going to die, and it's not a good investment. So if you want to go to school, you have to go to meetings. And so I didn't come here because I was willing. I didn't come here because I was done. I came here on a very bizarre tuition program, and I wasn't happy about it. And my experience is that willingness doesn't always feel like wanting to. And acceptance doesn't always feel like liking it or approval. And no one said those things of like, I spilled more than you drank or any of that to me. And I'm glad, because I think I would have been like, okay, I'm out. What they said to me was, your bottom is when you stop digging. You can get off the elevator at any floor. Usually, like, people don't end up here by accident. I heard recently, like, most alcoholics can remember their first drink vividly. Like, I just heard that, and I was like, that's so true. I can remember vividly. And that it's a turning point, you know? And so I got sober, and I wasn't happy about it. And, you know, for me, who had always felt like, I'm on the outside, you know. When I was drinking, it was like, drinking didn't make this ferret feel like a squirrel. It made me feel like, I'm a ferret, and I don't care. And when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was like, I'm a ferret. Look at all these other ferrets. I really want to be a squirrel. Like, I think I'm a squirrel. Let me tell you why I'm a squirrel. I've got to be a squirrel because I want to go back to drinking. And I didn't feel a sense of relief. Like, I understood that this was a gift for you guys, and I just wanted to maybe return it and pick it up later. And around the time that I got sober, a meeting had just started called Never Had a Legal Drink, And that meeting saved my life because it was other people with the same loophole that I had. It was that, for me, my loophole was, I'm too young, you know, but I've heard other people with their loopholes, which is, you know, I'm too old, or I have too much, or I lost too much, or whatever it is, that thing that makes us totally different, where this thing isn't going to work for us. And that meeting helped me, you know, not have that. And then also, I was introduced to a fellowship of people who loved me, not in spite of what I felt was my brokenness, but because of it. And we had a good time. Like, it's the disease where the medication is enjoyable and involves coffee and smoking and going to the diner really late. I mean, that was like, you know, we would go after the meeting. And so that was my experience. And when I was new, there's a thing that people say here, especially in New York, I don't know, it's like, we're going to love you until you learn to love yourself. And I was like, well, good luck with that. Because I hated myself. I hated myself. I was embarrassed of every single thing I said. I couldn't leave my house without having an interaction that I didn't play over and over and over and over. Everything that I did, I criticized. I never have talked to anyone the way that I talk to myself. I was so uncomfortable in my own skin. I used to pretend, there was a thing called movie phone, and I used to, at like a meeting, if there was a break, I would go and listen to movie phone, which was just telling me the dates and times of the movies in my area, and I would talk like it was a friend, and I would pretend to be on the phone so that I wouldn't have to talk to you guys. And I don't think that exists, so I'm not getting anyone any ideas, but... And I remember, like, someone saying, like, you can get out of yourself. Like, I would try to talk to, like, I give myself these things of just talk to three people, you know? Just go and talk to three people. And I was, so, I didn't know how to do it. I would just be like, I like your shoes. And then I would, like, run away. Like, I couldn't. And I remember, like, people in Alcoholics Anonymous have saved my life, right? And if you say to someone outside, or, like, someone saved my life, and they're like, oh, how? Like, you know, they rescued from a burning building, or, you know, pulled you from a, like, car accident. It's like, no, like, one person remembered my name when I was brand new. I'm telling you, this woman said, hi, Gemma, it's good to see you here. And I was like, you can see me? Like... One person brought me tea from across the room. And I think one of the things that, you know, with these online meetings, which have absolutely saved us, and that's incredible that we had that, but the thing that I've missed with the online meetings is that ability to see someone alone in the corner and cross the room and bring them a cup of tea, or know if someone ran out of a room, you know? And I'm so glad that we're back. You know, it's so good. When I was new, I had this, I had like a couple years, and I had this really terrible habit where I would go grocery shopping, and I would buy groceries. I would go to the farmer's market. I did not know how to cook, but I would go to the farmer's market, and I suddenly, there's something about being in a farmer's market where I'm like, I'm a chef. I'm a chef. I'm going to buy an eggplant, and I'm going to buy some peppers, and I'm going to buy this, and I'm going to buy that, and I have like all these vegetables, and I'm going to get this meat. And then I would bring it home, and I had no idea what to do with it, and would all rot. And I did not have like expendable income to be doing this, right? So... And my roommates had noticed, like, they're like, why do you buy all this food that you never make? So one time, I was alone, and there was this meat, and it was like not past the expiration date, but close, and it was gray. And I was like, you know what? This is what you deserve, to myself. This is what you deserve, because you always do this, you buy this food and you don't eat it, so you're gonna make this meat. So I put the meat in the pan, and it does not smell delicious, right? You know, have you ever done that where you're like smelling it? You're like, and then I cook it, it's like a different shade of gray now, and I'm like checking my calendar, like, do I have time for food poisoning? Like, do I have anything coming up? Like, and I sit down and eat my like rancid meat, and I cut into it, and I'm smelling each bite, and I'm like not enjoying it. And I thought about this friend I had who I adored. Her name was Sandy, and it still is, and we're still friends. But I thought, would I make Sandy eat this meat? I would never make Sandy eat this meat. And so then I was like, therefore, I'm not going to make myself eat this meat. So my experience is that I learned to love myself by learning how to love you. It is by learning how to love you and treat you that I have very, 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 very slowly learned how to love myself. And it is by going through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did not dive into the steps when I got here. And I did not dive into service, and I did not dive into anything. In fact, I sat in the back. I came on the days when I was sad. I came on my hard days, and if I was having a good day, I wouldn't go to a meeting because I didn't need it. I didn't know that maybe you needed me to be there. I only came when I needed a meeting. I remember when I had 4 years of sobriety, I called my sponsor and I told her I thought I was going to drink. And she said, well, where are you? And I said, I'm at the International AA Convention. True story. And she was like, well, what are you going to have? Which I thought was a very irresponsible question. I was like, I don't know. And she said, where are you going to get it? And I said, I don't know. And she said, I don't think you want to drink. I think you want to feel better. And that has been the thing that has helped me the most through my sobriety. Hello, puppy. It has been the thing that has helped me so much in my sobriety is to really pay attention to my language. And when I'm saying, I want to drink, I want to drink, I want to drink, it's because my mind does the alcoholic math that a drink is going to make me feel better, even though I don't have a lot of evidence for that. I have a lot of evidence for the opposite of that. But I replace that thought of I want to drink with I want to feel better or I want relief. And when I do that, that puts me into the solution rather than fantasizing about drinking. And I had a sponsor who was really careful with like language. And so I would say like, everybody hates me. And she's like, who's everybody, you know? And do they hate you, you know? I know like I never say I'm a bad mom. That's just not a phrase that I use because I have a head that will believe it. I will have a head that will be like, oh, you know, then maybe I should leave. Or they could do, you know, like, I can't afford to talk to myself that way. And let's see. So I was at about 4.5 years of sobriety, I heard a speaker who talked about alcoholism, and she talked about the disease of our thinking. And I was able to identify with it so incredibly much, you know, this idea that like my alcoholism, separate from whether or not I'm drinking, is centered in my mind and the way that I perceive the world and the way that I walk through the world, the way that feeling of impending doom, that waking up and feeling like nothing's going to work out, you know. My husband used to say, like, I can hear your mind from across the room, you know, like, and so I talk about this a lot, but, you know, I would come home and one time I came home and he said, hey, did you get cat food? And I started to cry. And he was like, what did you just hear? And I said, you said I was a bad wife. And it's because I heard, like, I hear the alcoholic, therefore, you know, did I get cat food? No, therefore, I didn't listen. Therefore, I'm not a good partner. Therefore, I, you know. And I have this black and white, all or nothing thinking in this way of, you know, connecting things that aren't connected and taking everything so personally. And, you know, like I missed my exit on a freeway. I'm like, well, I'll never write a book. Like those things are not connected. And for me, like a lot of that played out with like, I have alcoholism and I am right around the corner from happy. I just need one more thing and then I'll be fine. Like I just need this one thing and then I'll be okay. And forever, that was a relationship, you know, that was just a relationship. And I was so, you know, I dated men, I dated women. I was on a very thorough search for my person. And I don't know if you've ever seen like a cat that like rubs itself like up against a door and like, or your leg and like, but usually like a door, and they have like a whole experience, you know, they're like, oh, this is fantastic. But like from an emotional standpoint, that was like all my relationships. It was like the other person didn't even necessarily know anything was happening. Like I was like, I would call my sponsor, I'm like, I'm dating someone. And she'd be like, do they know? I ended up moving to LA for 6 months, 19 years ago. And that's the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's like I got here to LA and like I had a community immediately, you know? And the way that we speak in LA is very different than in New York. New York, it's 20 minutes. You know, in LA, it was a lot of like speaking for 45 minutes. And so I started speaking a lot and I loved it. You know, I loved going and traveling and speaking and doing the thing. And I got really, really in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started meetings, and I was doing the deal, and I was talking about the steps all the time, and I had a little problem with meditating. I couldn't really meditate, so I started a meditation meeting, which is not the same as meditating, and started an 11-step meeting, but didn't do an 11-step. Ever, and then I would just share about it every week. Attendance was low. And eventually, you know, what happened for me is that, like, I got those things on the list, right? Like, all I need, all I need, all I need, all I need is a relationship. Okay, great, you got one. You know, I met my husband, and then I was like, all I need is for us to get married, and then we did. And it's like, well, we can't live here. It's like, we need this house, and then there's an extra room. Like, we need to have a baby, but... And then I had the baby, and it was like, well, all I need, looking at this beautiful baby boy, all I need is a career, and then I'll be fine. Like, I will stop asking for stuff once that happens. And then I got that. But I knew, like, when my kid wasn't enough, I knew, like, oh, it's never going to be enough. Like, I can keep bringing things to the altar of my alcoholism, but it is never, ever, ever going to be enough, because I have that thing where I'm afraid I'm not going to get what I want, or I'm going to lose what I have. And it's never enough. And that's okay. I have to say, like, you know, I wasn't handed, like, I've been sober for 25 years and some change. Like, I wasn't handed 25 years of grace at my first meeting. Like, I've been handed grace a teaspoon at a time. And I've always, you know, I've always loved Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had this like big life, and I was going around and I was speaking, and I we're really committing to that noise. Okay. Sorry, I'm easily thrown these days. These days being my 40s, which have been going on for a long time. We can play a game. What was I saying? What?
25 years.
Teaspoons of grace. Okay, great. So I had all these, the things that I thought I needed, right? But it wasn't enough. And basically what happened was I was starting to think about drinking. But I didn't want to talk about it, and I certainly didn't want to talk about it from the podium, and I didn't want to be open about it, but I was like starting to think about it a little bit more often and for a little bit longer than I was before. And for me, what happened was, I'm going to back up. There's a guy who says, don't have conversations with people who aren't in the room, right? And so I remember when my husband and I first got married, we didn't have a kid yet, and I was driving over a hill, over Laurel Canyon, and I remember I'd had a good day, and I was going into Laurel Canyon, and I started to think about, like, what if my mother-in-law moves here? And, like, I was like, that's not happening. Why am I thinking about that? I shouldn't think about that. I don't need to think about that. And then I just started to think about it. Like, and I drove into Laurel Canyon, and I'm thinking, if we have a baby, my mother-in-law will move here. And then she will have twins, and they will like her more than they like me, and it will affect my marriage. And I just start playing out this whole story, right? Like, that she's going to move here and ruin my life. And I, like, get to the other side. You know, it's like a 15-minute drive. My hair is, like, askew. Like, I've been through all these scenarios. Like, I get home and, like, I'm like, I'm home, you know, like, my husband's like, did we pre-fight about something on your way here? Like, what's happening? And I used to have a sponsor who told me I would try to get ahead of the bullet. Like, I was constantly trying to think of the thing that was going to hurt me and come up with it so that I could, you know, but there's never been a situation that was, you know, painful where I'm like, oh, you know, I was afraid of this happening. I was afraid of this person dying. Like, good thing I worried about it, because now it's not a big deal. Like, that's never worked out for me. And so what happened in this case is that a year later I got pregnant and my mother-in-law moved to LA. And we were very different people. And I thought she was spectacular. She was like this woman who could, like, you know, she would be like, oh, don't throw out that paper towel holder. I'm going to make a maraca. Like, I just had a baby. I could not get it together. Like, I couldn't cook. I couldn't clean. And she's like Martha Stewart. And every time she would bring home something, you know, like bring dinner. And I would think, oh, she thinks I can't take care of my family. You know, and I took everything she did personally. And I had a sponsor who told me, you know, like, you have to put pen to paper, you know? And so there's a thing I can do when I have a resentment. I can bring it to, like, people who aren't sober. I can just say the word mother-in-law and people will be like, oh, yeah, tell me about it. I can feed it. You know, if I have a resentment, I can feed it. I can cook for it. I can feed it. Well, I can't cook for anything, but, you know, whatever. And or I can work the steps on it. And so I did this inventory. And in that inventory, which I was sure would not work because my resentment was so, you know, it's like, this isn't going to, like, 10 minutes of writing, how is that going to do anything? But I did this work, and in that, I was able to find compassion for her and compassion for myself. And it was more than 10 minutes because I had to do it over and over and over again. But eventually, I let her off the hook. And what happened was, I think 5 years after she moved here, she had to go to the doctor, and she had to have a tiny procedure. And on Valentine's Day, 2016, she went to get this procedure, and she died. And it was so shocking and so awful. And we were so, I mean, they had said it was a procedure before. They called a procedure, but afterwards they called it major surgery. It was like, but we were so stunned and we were so confused. But I just remember looking at her and knowing I was clean, knowing that I didn't owe her an amends, because years before, when she had moved here, I had done the work and I hadn't let my resentment of her get in the way of my relationship with her. She didn't even really know about it. And what I couldn't have predicted when I was driving over the hill thinking, oh, she's going to move here, she's going to move here, is that she took care of my son so that I could work and have a career and do all of that. And she got on the floor with him and she played with him day in, day out in a way that I am not built to do. And there is almost, I think, everything I love about my kid, she helped put there. Her moving here is the thing that taught me how to do an inventory. It is the thing that taught me how to have compassion, and it was the greatest gift. And I never, ever could have guessed that when I was getting ahead of the bullet. And a year and 4 days after she died, my father died. And he died super, not suddenly. He was 12 years, and it was like a whole thing. And so what happened was, I was left with all this grief. And for me, I have really big feelings about small things, but I have really small feelings about big things. And I don't feel my feelings in real time. And I think grief is weird. It is so weird. It's like I can cry over a commercial, but my dad died and I could not cry. I could not cry. And then I felt bad. I felt terrible. What kind of dog? I'm not even crying. Months later, I was looking for something in my closet. I was looking for a belt, this little black belt, and I couldn't find it, and I started to cry, and I started screaming, it isn't fair, it isn't fair, it isn't fair. And my husband came in, and he's like, he knew this isn't about the belt, and I cried for 2 hours. And so my experience of grieving like that is that, like, if you're going through that and something comes up and it seems tiny and it seems insignificant and you wonder, why am I crying about this tiny thing? Like, in my experience, it's not about the tiny thing. It's about the ocean of grief that we have inside us that comes out where it can. And so my policy is to let it out wherever I can, if it is safe to do so and I'm not driving, I can pull over. So my grief for these two losses, you know, my family of six became a family of four, and my grief, I think, showed up 3 years after the losses. And because grief is weird, I feel like I didn't recognize it as grief. I just thought I was losing my mind because nothing had just happened. And I think that the past couple of years, like, whether grief comes in all different shapes and sizes, and like, we all had to give up a lot. And so there's grief everywhere, right? Like, of things that we lost and things that changed. And but my particular grief took some time to show up. And when it did, I heard this guy, Phil, say, like, I have a disease and it is going to get treated. It's going to get treated with drugs and alcohol, or it's going to get treated with steps in God, or it's going to find another way. And I just found other ways. I found other ways to treat my alcoholism without the steps and without God. But I was still flying around and talking about all those things. And it's not that I was lying. I just was not aware that my information wasn't current. And for me, like, when I moved to LA and we got this house and it had a white picket fence, and like, I used to think, like, oh, I'd see a white picket fence, I'm like, oh, those people are happy. And then I got a white picket fence, I was like, oh, these don't work. For me, this is, you know, if you're new, welcome. My experience of having time is that it can be a white picket fence. And it can be hard when you have time to admit that you're not doing well, or that you're scared, or you're going through something hard. And it's not that you have to admit it to everyone, but in my experience, I have to tell at least one person, and that is usually my sponsor. So I went through something in sobriety when I had 21 years where the wheels fell off the bus and I hit a wall that was enormous, and I completely went through a loss, and I, not a death, but a loss, and I couldn't get over it, and I couldn't stop crying, and I couldn't see how I was ever going to feel okay again. And so I did two things. I allowed myself to cry whenever I needed to, and I let myself grieve, and I thought that was going to be a couple weeks, but it was literally a year of crying every day, but not all day. It's like the rain in Seattle. Like, it's not all day, but it is every day. And then the other thing is I did the steps over again, and I went to my sponsor, and I started over. And, you know, I did the first step, but for me, the thing... You know, I'm powerless. I'm powerless over alcohol. I'm powerless. My life is unmanageable. And what other things? You know, there are other things that I am powerless over. It makes my life unmanageable. But the thing for me was the second step. Came to believe a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Like, I had skipped that step. Like, I was like, oh, yeah, I got that. But that it was a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, not... Like, I believed that, but I thought also, yeah, but so could the right shoes, so could the right job, so could the right relationship, so could this, so could that, so could being in this neighborhood. You know, it was like all these things that I thought on the outside were going to fill the God-shaped hole, right, and never, ever could. And, you know, turning my will and my life over to God... In this situation, I was locked in obsession. I was obsessed. And I've always had obsession. It's like the problem isn't the problem, right? It's like in my alcoholism, it's like I think all I need is this thing. And then, but when I get that, it's like, no, all I need is this thing. All I need is this thing. I need this problem to work out. It's like if I'm in the problem, it's like it doesn't matter what the problem is. The solution is to treat my alcoholism. And I have a story that I share all the time, but when my husband and I first moved to our house, we in the backyard there was a lime tree, and I was pretty excited about it. I'm from New York. It's like, we have a lime tree. And people are coming over, they're like, what should we bring? I'm like, whatever you do, don't bring limes, we have a tree. And I went to, get the first lime, and it was hard as a rock. It, I was like, okay, that's fine. My harvest is not ready. That's fine. And then, next week, same thing. And I started to resent the tree, and then it became, a symbol of, how things don't work out for me. And then the tree fell off the tour of the backyard, and then I just started to resent citrus in general. And summer was over, and good riddance. And... Then I came home one day in November, and my husband was sitting in the living room, and he was eating an orange, and I knew I hadn't bought it. I was like, where'd you get that? And he was like, from the lime tree. And we went outside, and our lime tree was covered in oranges. And he said to me, why did you think, who told you that this... And I was like, nobody, it just looked like one. And for me, that is my, instead of turning my life and my will over, of what is this gonna be? I decide, this is supposed to be this. You're supposed to do that. I'm supposed to live there. I'm supposed to get that. And then when it doesn't work out, I get resentful. And so, you know, being able to do an inventory and looking, getting down to the causes and conditions of, you know, relieves me of that. And so when I was going through this difficult year, I was like, I should do an inventory. And I was like, I don't know, it'll be a few pages, 200 pages. And that is the weight that I was carrying around. That is what was blocking my vision from every interaction I had, because every interaction I had was reminding me of something that was in that 200 pages, right, before I wrote it down. And then I turned it over to a sponsor who was able to sit across from me and love me like crazy. And I know from listening to a fifth step that someone can walk in the door and I can love them, and then they can tell me all these things, their worst thoughts and actions, whatever. And when they leave, I know that I love them even more than when they showed up. And I trusted that that was the experience that, you know, I had with her. And I did... For me, the other thing that that felt like a third step is, at the time, my son, he's really into Lego, and so we would, build these Lego sets, and we'd put all the pieces on the table, and like I am very negative, and I'm like, I don't see how this is going to work out. Like, I don't understand how these 3,000 pieces are going to be a fire truck. I just don't see it working out. So I do what makes sense to me, which is to put the tires together, because even in a sea of pieces, you can find the two things that are the tires. And so I would always, first thing, start to do that, and he would say, Mom, it is not tire time. The steps are in the book, and they're in an order, and we're going to follow it. Now, he was talking about the Lego book, but it applies. And when I went through this time, I felt like a pile of pieces. I felt like I was a pile of pieces on, you know, on the table. And I wrote to my friend today because I was thinking about what he said. I said, what's that thing that you say about steps? And he knew what I was talking about, which is great. And his prayer is, please help me use these steps and this fellowship to find my way, not get my way. That's John N. And so when I did this inventory, I knew what I wanted to come out of it. And I went to a meeting and I heard him say that. And instead, I did this inventory and I went through the steps in a way that was to find my way, not get my way. And in the course of the steps, I had to face some very big things about myself. And and that thing that Holly read today, that where you got so emotional, was so beautiful, because there was that thing about the freedom to be me, to live authentically, is the greatest gift that I get here. And, you know, I did, in the sixth and seventh step, like, I heard Carrie White, who just passed away, talk about defects of character, but she talked about them as, like, defect, like when we defect from ourselves or we defect from God, when they're the things that take us away from ourselves and God. She also said this great thing, like, there is no inclement weather, only inappropriate dress, which to me tells me I can do anything as long as I'm prepared, you know? And the way that I prepare is by going to a meeting and by doing my morning thing, and then I can go into the world. And, you know, I did amends, I wrote out my men's list, and I realized I never finished my ninth step. I had 23 years of sobriety when I finished my ninth step during the pandemic. And one of the things that happened, there was a day where I was making breakfast for my son, and I made him this egg, and I hard-boiled it, or I was soft-boiling it, whatever. I boiled it. I was trying to take the shell off, and like when my husband takes it off, like it just magically comes off. And when I took it off, like every little bit was sticking to the egg, and like it just didn't look good. Like it looked like a brain, and it was overcooked, and I just looked at it and I was like, kill yourself, you know? Like that's how it felt. And that is, for me, when I get confused, like between I made a mistake and I am a mistake. And one of the things that I've heard here is, like, I have other gifts. And that I can't do all things. Cooking is one of them. And when I cook, the smoke alarm goes off. And then you can hear me go, I have other gifts. I am getting better. But anyway, you know, in the 10th step, I don't do a nightly 10-step, but I have had times when I do, and those are the times when I'm happier. That constant looking at what I'm doing and what I've done in the day, and also being, you know, making amends in real time. And then I have an 11-step practice that I discovered in that year when I cried. Like, I was finally willing to be uncomfortable, and then I was willing to do something different, and I started from meditating for 20 minutes a day. And I remember being in a meeting shortly after that and having this sense that, you know, all those voices that say terrible things, but I had this other voice that was like, I have you. I was like, who's that? And I realized that I had had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. I had a profound alteration to the way that I experience life because I walked through these steps. And then the pandemic happened, and like, you know, when a global pandemic seems like a happy ending, like you just had a terrible year. I am here this weekend because I told Kathy years and years ago that I would be. But I have taken a speaking break, and I haven't been speaking a lot. And the reason for that is that I've been walking through a very difficult time in my family. And one of the things that for me, don't get scared, for me, with all of that time of walking through the steps and meditating and getting quiet and listening to the still small voice, is that I came to the incredibly painful realization that I had to leave my marriage. And I did that in October. And my husband, I'd still call him that just because we were together for 18 years. My husband's an Al-Anon. And I thought in the pandemic, when he got an Al-Anon and I was in AA, I was like, this is gonna do it. This is gonna save our marriage. You're gonna be an Al-Anon, I'm gonna be an AA. And it's gonna work, it's gonna work. I have seen Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon save families, absolutely save marriages. I've absolutely, in my case, there were other things going on and it didn't. But Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon saved my family. Because though we are separated, we're happier than we've ever been. My husband's like my best friend. We text 20 times a day. Like, we just went on a family vacation. We have a vacation home that we share as a family. It's been incredibly painful for both of us, but we've navigated it with grace and dignity, which includes mucus and crying. It is a happy ending of sorts because I had the courage to change the things that I could, even though it was so incredibly hard. And within 6 months of it, my husband turned to me. We went to therapy, I heard somewhere to put as much care getting out of a marriage as you do getting into one. And so that's what we did. And I work these steps every day to the best of my ability, and he does too. And you know, 6 months in, he turned to me, and it was tough. I mean, it was hard, but he turned to me, and he thanked me, you know? And so when we say how it works, my experience is that it works under any conditions whatsoever. And it works even when things don't, quote unquote, work out. To me, this isn't about, oh, like, I got sober and then everything was perfect, or, you know, like, there have been tremendous gifts in my sobriety, absolutely, but there have also been heartaches and loss and pain, and I certainly do not have the, I have seen people walk through, I mean, incredible tragedy and stay sober through a loss of a kid or illness or a spouse or all of the above or a house burning down or anything, and that we don't do this alone. The thing that I have seen when anyone walks through anything, and when I walk through my things, is that I'm surrounded by the fellowship. I'm surrounded by people who helped me pack or unpack or showed up or told me what my next step was to be, or listened to me cry, or told me when I had the best idea of what I thought I would say that would really help him to understand the situation. They gave me an alternate script that helped me to get through it. And so Alcoholics Anonymous saved me from my drinking. It also saves me from myself, you know, what my best thinking is. And, you know, I am the happiest that I've ever been. And I am in my skin. And there's that thing that we say, we're gonna learn to love you until you learn to love yourself. It is the weirdest saying, because it sounds like the minute you love yourself that everyone's like, all right, we're out. and that is not my experience. I'll close with this. Like, I am someone who always wants to say, hi, hello. Oh my God. I love the sound of babies in a meeting, because that's the sound of parents staying sober. And it never, and that's giggling, but that's what I try to think about when there's crying. I try and think about like that, you know, that good and bad, you know, like in the pandemic, I would say like, oh, today was a good day. Oh, today was a bad day. This was a good day. And I was like, I wasn't pandemicking right. And I didn't make bread. And I was so worried, you know, it's like, I'm having a terrible whatever. And I have retired the terms good and bad from my vocabulary. I do not know. My worst night drinking brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. My year of crying brought me to God. 2020, the worst year in history, brought me to myself. A really difficult time in my marriage has brought us to a new kind of freedom. I do not know what is best for me. I do not know what is best for you. My experience is if I just show up here and I'm of service and I get out of myself, that my higher power takes care of the rest and it unfolds as it should. And for that, I'm incredibly grateful. I hope you enjoy the rest of your weekend, and thank you so much.